Yes, this morning we are going to do something for our last Sunday school that I thought would be appropriate because there is an amazing birthday that we should all be interested in that's going to be celebrated tomorrow on June 11th. And somebody or something is going to be 76 years old. What is it? You tell me the birthday. Well, it's the OPC birthday, of course. It's when the church was started in Philadelphia in 1936. And it's so important for us to understand our own story, our own history, because that is part of what forms our identity as we see how the Lord has worked in our little denomination for 76 years. We have so much to be thankful for. And there are, of course, many different denominations, and that's often lamented by Christians, and yet in reality there's a blessing to denominations, and that is that oftentimes in history, and I believe the OP was clearly a case of this, of a denomination starting out of a love for the truth, and not over little differences, but over the fundamental foundation of the gospel, of the incarnation, of the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, and all of the truths that are connected with our triune God rescuing sinners. There is, of course, a danger in denominationalism that we might think that we are perfect and that everyone else doesn't really have the answers. I have not really seen this in the OPC. It's, I'm sure, at times a temptation, but we are part of a wonderful worldwide connectedness with many other Reformed denominations, both in the U.S. and in a number of other nations throughout the world. And so we need to know our history in order to stay humble. We can learn from our mistakes because we can see those as well written in our histories. I think in the modern world, history is being neglected because we think that the latest thing, the latest fad, is, and the latest generation knows best, and that we really don't need to learn anything from history. And I think that, of course, is a grave mistake, and very important then to know who we are as a denomination. Now, there are several different streams of interpretation of church history, and particularly of our history. And John Meather, our historian, has pointed these out in various ways. And the two basic streams would be that the OPC, according to the main line, is a kind of off-brand. And I remember a young woman who was very excited about the gospel and the Reformed faith in New Rochelle joined us many years ago, the little mission work in New Rochelle, New York. And her parents, who were in the main line, PCUSA, said, "Oh, you're going to join the off-brand." And, of course, that was not meant as a compliment, though I think it stimulated her daughter to want to see if this was, in fact, something better than what her parents had raised her in. And then, of course, there's the evangelical view of our history, which would look at us as being much too concerned about doctrinal details, precisionism, and maybe even believing that we're guilty of a kind of Pharisaism. We believe in the commandments of God, that we need to take his law seriously as an outworking of our discipleship in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so that interpretation would be the other. So mainline, evangelical, and now we're going to give a very brief overview, bringing you up to the birth date of the OPC, which we'll celebrate tomorrow on Monday. And here are a bunch of things that you might want to read as you consider OPC history, and if this lecture stimulates you to think and explore more deeply into our roots. And so a few things to read, a couple of short pieces, why the Orthodox Presbyterian Church is available from the Christian Ed Committee. You can get that on the website, and I think it's very, very inexpensive. By the way, if you don't go to opc.org, very often, you ought to get familiar with that site. It's a content-rich site, and I'm prejudiced because I'm on the little committee that oversees the maintenance of that site, and years ago we all got together and redesigned it, and I think it's just got so many different areas that you can learn more about the Bible and about the Reformed faith and about the OPC. So on the left, there is publications. And if you go to publications, I think it's the third button down on the left bar, you can find all kinds of things that our committee publishes, and they're all just basically for the publishing cost. And so why the OPC? Lest We Forget would be another one by Bob Churchill. That's a nice little reflection on his life and ministry, and the being a one of the founding ministers. And then Fighting the Good Faith by John Meather and Daryl Hart is brings the history up to date, sort of, up to, let's say, I think to the 80s. And then The Presbyterian Conflict by Edwin Ryan, if you want to go into really deep discussion of all the intricacies of the battle that took place that led to the formation of the OPC, Ryan is a pretty reliable source. And then if you want to read also about Machen himself, which of course includes a lot about the OPC and its founding, there is the biographical memoir written by Ned Stonehouse, sort of written in the 19th century style of biographies, where you get lots of letters loaded with biographical facts. But then if you want to place it more in the history of the church and in the history of the society in which Machen was raised, then Defending the Faith, Daryl Hart's biography, is a wonderful way to sort of balance out the other biography. The two really go together as a nice complement. So, what are our roots? My friend Stephen Treacy would like to hear this because they're Irish Presbyterian. And so, Scotch-Irish, that is, or Scottish-Irish immigrants began to come in the latter part of the 18th century. Early on, the first Presbyterian minister to come here, really the founder of our church, was Francis McAmee from Donegal, Northern Ireland, and he led the first Presbytery meeting in Philadelphia with six ministers in 1716. And from that, the Synod of Philadelphia was formed, and by 1729, a few decades later, they adopted the Westminster standards and subscribed to all essential and necessary articles. And then in 1789, the first General Assembly took place, and they revised the Confession of Faith. Very important fact to know, revising it from the English edition, which really confused the relationship between the civil magistrate and the church, and making the church entirely independent and having no authority over the state, and the state in turn having nothing but civil authority over the church. In other words, the king could not call a convention of the church or a meeting of the church to decide a particular matter. And so a very distinctly American version then was formed in 1789. Now, something else that happened in the middle of the 18th century, there was a distinction, a very important distinction that began to become a thematic, a theme that ran through the whole of our history and is still present today, and that is the difference between the old side and the new side. Now, this is often confused with the old light and the new, and I mean the new school and the old school. But old side, new side is a different distinction, though the two are definitely related. And the new side would favor the Great Awakening. And it's interesting because I would have always thought, well, that's me. You know, it was Jonathan Edwards and it was the New England revivalist, Whitfield. These are all, we think of them as our friends. But we need to remember that the old side was not just a bunch of liberals. There was a distinct concern that the means of grace, the ordinary, everyday, every Sunday means of grace, were being neglected. And in some cases, during the Awakening, the Second Great Awakening was even worse in this regard. There was a tremendous disrespect for the regular clergy. And some of the worst extremes basically denigrated their education, the need for education. We don't really need to. You need to be filled with the Spirit. So there was this very odd kind of an almost charismatic emphasis there. And so it's taught me, as I've studied this over the last three decades, that revivalism has a downside, and so the old side had some very important critiques of that revivalism, which we need to pay attention to. And I would say that, you know, within the OPC, there has always been a tension there between those two poles, and so that's something just to be aware of. Now, in 1801, something very important happened called the Plan of Union. And the Plan of Union essentially said that the local church would decide whether it's going to be Presbyterian or Congregational. Interestingly, we have our own history within this area shows what happened at this time. And if you go to the Bedford Presbyterian Church, they made that decision, decided to go Presbyterian, and they were in communication with First Congregational in Merrimack. And First Congregational in Merrimack, as they discussed it, they decided, no, we're Congregational, and we want to go and be Congregational Church, which they, of course, are to this very day. And so that Plan of Union looked like a good thing. The Presbyterians would focus on the frontier and the middle colonies, of course, which is where the origin of our churches is or was. And then the Congregationalists would pretty much take over New England. And this area used to have dozens of Presbyterian churches. Only a few of them remain today. But what happened also was that there was the New England theology came into the picture, and it was something that began to infect all of the churches, Congregational and Presbyterian. And what they did basically in the New England theology, without going into too much detail, they denied the imputation of Adam's sin. They affirmed a universal atonement and also a denial of covenant theology and election, or what's called decretal theology. So it was a bad influence there. And it was in 1812, I think partly at least in response to that theology, that Princeton Theological Seminary was founded. And it was founded there in the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton Theological Seminary. Princeton University. And so the seminary was attached very closely then to the liberal arts institution known as the College of New Jersey. And their goal was to train men in the Bible, in the Westminster Standards. And the first professor, Archibald Alexander, was followed quickly by Samuel Miller. Alexander has the large hall named after him there at Princeton. And also Miller has the chapel named after him. And sadly, of course, the gospel is not heard there the way it once was in his day. Charles Hodge, of course, came along a bit later in 1820, and they believed that they should vigorously, intelligently, and charitably oppose the New England theology. And if you go back and look at some of the old Princeton reviews and things that Hodge particularly wrote, it was a very penetrating and profound critique from a biblical perspective of those erroneous doctrines. Now, churches, of course, are never free of conflict. And so, in a sense, the history of the church is a history of conflicts. And so, in 1837, there was a new disruption. The old school and the new school separated. And so, within Presbyterianism, there was the old school and the new school. And the new school favoring revival, minimizing the importance of confessions and catechisms, and minimizing the need for an educated clergy and that kind of thing. And so 100,000 communicant members, 533 congregations. So this is a group. They were larger churches than ours are ordinarily, and probably about twice, almost twice as many as our whole denomination. They left, and it split the church pretty much right in half. Then, of course, in the Civil War, so you've got old school and new school spread throughout the country, and then you have the divide in the Civil War, North and South, and so you had really four entities then, and it was only in the latter part of the 20th century that the mainline churches actually got back together and joined forces, and the new school, old school influence, of course, was completely eliminated, and eventually that's what became the OPC and the PCA from the South. The OPC being more northern oriented and the PCA being more southern oriented. And so, let's see, in the old school, new school. So the old school would have been really focusing on the importance of orthodoxy, of doctrine, of knowing the catechisms and teaching them, of men subscribing and really affirming the whole system of doctrine in the Westminster Confession of Faith. And so there was this new school element, which also had a new side element that we talked about a few minutes ago there, and also the New England theology, and so you had all of these streams coming into the church. And so in 1903, there was a very famous, or really it's an infamous, confession was proposed, and that confession added a couple of chapters to the Westminster Confession. Now, we don't have that confession, because what it was a move, a very subtle move, to introduce a broader theology, to undercut election and regeneration, and to really broaden so that Arminians, for example, who put more of an emphasis on the human will, would be allowed to be happy with this confession. A very famous theologian at Princeton at the time, Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield, was very articulate in opposing this new confession, but in fact he lost, and that became the confession of the church. And so in 1906, another influence, there was a reunion with the very new school Cumberland Presbyterian Church, and they came in, and again a very emphasis on revival against the over against theology, evangelism opposed to strict subscription for officers in the church. And then in 1918, between 1918 and 1920, while it got rejected, it shows you what's happening to the life of the church, that there's something called the Philadelphia Plan that Dr. J. Ross Stevenson proposed, which would be an organic union with 18 evangelical Protestant churches. So we're talking about going way outside of Presbyterianism and Reformed theology, and having basically a church that was had a general union of doctrine, that we believe the gospel and the Trinity and a few fundamental things of that nature. Well, it was defeated, but it shows you that there were 100, actually over a third of the church, 100 presbyteries. Imagine that. We have 17 presbyteries, and 100 was only a third of the church. So there were over 300 presbyteries, and they were in favor of this. So even though it was defeated, it showed you that the church was in real trouble. When someone asked B.B. Warfield if he thought that there would be a church split sometime before he died, I think this would have been in the somewhere around 1918, or probably during the time when this was being proposed, and he said, no, because you can't split rotten wood. I thought, wow, that's an interesting analogy, because anyone who's ever done any wood splitting knows what the rotten stuff is. You can't. It just kind of crumbles. And that's the state of the church in Warfield's estimation. And so then another conflict began to develop within the church, which is really where our immediate origins are defined, and that is through J. Gresham Machen. And he was really a mighty warrior in the cause of the truth. Yes, Landon. The question is, was the church separated north and south? And the answer is yes. So we're dealing with the northern church at this time. And thank you for that clarification, because that becomes important in a part of the history we won't get to today. So Machen, then, is a brilliant young man. He gets his degree, a real classical education, from Johns Hopkins University. And he goes on. He's raised in a very literate family. His mother and father both were authors. His mother wrote, I believe it was something to do with Christianity in the poetry of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. So a very highly educated family, and they were essentially Orthodox. His dad, I believe, was a lawyer. It came from a very highly cultivated background. And so he went off, really didn't quite know what he was going to do in his life, and so went off to study New Testament. He had been to the seminary at Princeton, and he went off to Germany and figured that he would study the most powerfully intellectual liberals in the Western world. And that's exactly what he did. I happen to have this wonderful book called Christianity and Conflict. Back in the early days, I was stupid enough to mark it up with a pen because it's a first edition of this little booklet. And he really tells you of his battle spiritually when he went to Germany. If you studied any theology, these names will all stand out as giants. So he studied at Marburg. He studied under Hermann, Jülicher, Weiss, and Bauer. Now, you'll notice Bauer from the lexicon that's used, the Greek lexicon for the Greek New Testament, and is still used today. Amazing scholars. And then at Göttingen, he studied under Schur, Bousset, and Heitmüller. And these were men of enormous intellectual and scholarly ability. And it's interesting. I'm also reading right now a book that I know Ginny read and enjoyed. It's an amazing story of Bonhoeffer, yes. Or I guess someone has said it's pronounced Bonhoeffer. Anyway, so Bonhoeffer's history is that he is trained also in the same amazing, in Berlin, this amazing intellectual environment. And then he comes during the Great Depression, it was 1929, to this country, studies at Union Theological Seminary, and he could have been a teacher there because he had his PhD at that point. But what he noted was that the students simply parroted what their liberal professors were saying. And so Bonhoeffer was very unimpressed by the intellectual caliber of the average American student. And in fact, he actually said that the fundamentalists, who were always being made fun of by these students at Union, had more intellectual integrity than they did. But it shows you the power of that German university. That's where all of the PhDs in the 19th century came from. And very, very important to appreciate what he was up against. So he was up against the greatest liberal theological minds in the English, or not in the English, but the Western world. And he went there, and it's through that battle, through struggling with all of these liberal notions, especially that living a life of integrity modeled after Jesus is really the essence of the Christian faith. He came to believe that the gospel of the Son of God, the death, the incarnation, the death, resurrection on the third day, that this was the essence of the gospel. It was a message. And only based on that message could a Christian life be built. And if you didn't get the message, then the Christian life may be a decent life in many ways, but it's not truly Christian. And so he really, by God's grace, won the battle. And remember, in his day, and I think there was even some of this in his family, as Hart points out in his biography, in his day, you had this idea in the American church and the American Presbyterian church that the Bible is not a supernatural book, but it gives us examples of noble lives to live. And so He makes the statement, Machen does, in Christianity in Conflict. He says, all the usefulness of Christianity can never lead us to be Christians unless the Christian religion is true. So in his day, it was, well, it's useful, sort of like Thomas Jefferson's Bible. The miracles, that's what pre-scientific minds believed in. But we don't need those. We just need the example of Jesus, who was the great teacher of how to live a good life. And so he's saying, no, unless the gospel, the good news of the incarnation, his substitutionary death, and his bodily resurrection on the third day is true, there's no such thing as Christianity. And of course, this ended up being the source of great conflict. He came back then and was prepared to be an instructor in New Testament at Princeton in 1906. And over the course of the years ahead, he would write a number of influential books: The Origin of Paul's Religion, Christianity and Liberalism, New Testament Greek for Beginners, What is Faith, and The Virgin Birth of Christ. I actually thought you might get a kick out of seeing a couple of interesting things. This is a first edition of What is Faith, and and they're all available now in paperback versions, and I would highly recommend this. This is a very popular book. It's written for the intelligent layperson, and it's amazingly germane to life in the church today. Then also, a wonderful book of sermons that I also just a few years ago was able to pick up a first edition with the dust cover still existing. And this is God Transcendent and Other Sermons. These are remarkable sermons. Robin and I have tended to read these during vacation in the summertime, and so we're working our way through this. I read it back in seminary, available again in a paperback. I think that the Banner of Truth Trust puts this out, and these are just wonderful sermons.
Those are all Machen sermons?
And these are all Machen sermons, right. This is all Machen. And it's called God Transcendent and Other Sermons, but I think that the Banner of Truth edition just has God Transcendent. Then if you want something that is, without reading a long book, this is a wonderful piece of scholarship that Daryl Hart did a number of years ago now, which is the Selected Shorter Writings of J. Gresham Machen. So it's got everything from the theological writings to wonderful things like Why Mountains and Why I Love Them, and the value of walking and things. He used to write for things like Ladies' Circle magazine, popular magazines in the day. It'd be sort of like writing for Vanity Fair or something, and that's what in the day the voice of the clergyman and of the professor was still listened to in the wider culture much more than it is today. And then finally, something we're going to talk about briefly here in a moment is this book that's called Modernism and the Board of Foreign Missions of the Presbyterian Church in the USA. And this is basically, this is Machen's expose of what was actually happening on the Board of Foreign Missions. And there were people who did not believe in any of the historic Christian faith who were not only on the board, but on the mission field. And we'll see how this unfolds now as we look at what went on with Machen. Also, something else that's just been published, and the professor in Escondido at Westminster, and his name is escaping me, he edited all of the letters that Machen wrote home to his parents and others during World War I. And he was over there and worked with the Red Cross, and that's just been published, so just a couple months ago, and it's available through Solid Ground Christian Books. Is a really good deal on it. We might want to get a copy of that, Dave, to have on hand. In 1923, after he'd really been teaching for quite a while in the seminary, Machen was stated supply in the First Presbyterian Church of Princeton. So this would have been the big Presbyterian church where all the professors went, and he preached the straight gospel. He preached some of the sermons in that book, God Transcendent, in that very place. And there was someone who I believe had been a friend of his family, a university professor named Henry Van Dyke. And he left the church because of Machen's preaching, because he was simply a liberal and believed that Christianity is meant to be useful for making us better human beings, but the supernatural part of it is not necessary. And so Machen, of course, was pressing the supernatural gospel of Jesus Christ. And it was there during that time that he published Christianity and Liberalism. And it was in that book that he basically said that modernism, which is another term for liberalism back in his day, modernism is another religion. It's not Christianity. He didn't use the word humanism, but it's humanism with a veneer of Christianity over it. But it's not truly Christianity. And of course, this caused a huge stir in the church. Now, during the same time, a couple of other really important things happened. There was a man named Harry Emerson Fosdick. And in fact, Metaxas, in his Bonhoeffer book, gets this wrong. It's an amazing book. And so I always feel, wow, I actually found a mistake in this amazing book. But it was an inadvertent mistake. But he says that Fosdick was the pastor of the church in the Presbyterian Church in New York City. He was not the pastor because he was a Baptist. And he was a stated supply, which means that you're there as an interim pastor, in a temporary situation. But he preached a very controversial sermon called "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" And in that day, the word fundamentalist was meant to refer to people like Machen, who believed the supernatural gospel. And so this set off a huge groundswell. And in 1923, there was still enough conservatism in the General Assembly so that something called the Deliverance was passed in the General Assembly. And it basically said that you cannot be a minister in the Presbyterian Church if you don't believe in at least these five fundamentals: the infallibility of Scripture, the virgin birth of Christ, the substitutionary atonement, Christ's bodily resurrection, and his miracles. Now, this was a good thing in one sense, because it was really a response to the Fosdick problem. But it's a bad thing in another sense, because it sort of reduced the confession to these five fundamentals. And that's where fundamentalism comes from. And so, in the day, it was seen as being a good thing by the conservatives. But in fact, it was reducing the confessional commitment of the church in a fairly serious way, which came back to haunt us in the early days of the OPC. And we won't have time to get to that this morning. But then in 1924, right after Machen publishes Christianity and Liberalism, Fosdick publishes The Modern Use of the Bible. These were the Lyman Beecher lectures at Yale. And he denied the infallibility of Scripture and basically said Christianity is a life, not a dogma. A scary thing is that I hear the same thing being said among evangelicals today, that Christianity is a life, it's not a doctrine. And doctrine and dogma are dangerous because they divide the church, because they make people argue and say nasty things to each other. And so Christianity is a life. If you don't know church history, then you don't know that what you're saying is exactly what the liberals who were denying the supernatural gospel of Jesus Christ were saying in Machen's day. How important, then, it is for us to know this history. So then, there was, in 1924, just a year later, a GA committee approves of Fosdick's preaching and says it's okay. So here you can see how rotten the wood was at that point. And so, in the same year in which the Deliverance had been passed, so we're back now to the five fundamentals, in December of 1923, the infamous Auburn Affirmation was signed by 150 ministers. I actually have an original copy of this. It's kind of a fold-out document that's pretty big. And it's got all 1,300 ministers that signed it, and they were from all over the church. And it's really a denial of the five fundamentals. So think of the contradiction here, that what the Auburn affirmationists were saying was that these were just theories. They are theological theories that you may or may not believe, but it shouldn't mean that you can't be a Presbyterian minister. And that's where Machen, of course, is, you know, he's screaming out to the church, no, supernaturalism and Christianity are the same, and modernism is not Christianity. It's a simply humanistic doctrine. And so what happened, of course, is that liberals had infiltrated all of the boards of the church, and a lot of those who were moderate and didn't want to cause trouble, they were, I think, relatively orthodox in their own views, but they didn't want to cause trouble, and so they never did anything about it. And so it's you know, the silence of good men can be a real problem, and it turned out to be just that during this time in our history. And so at Princeton, you still had stalwarts teaching. You had amazing men who were absolutely solid, and they were brilliant theologians, and they stuck to the gospel. You had William Brenton Green, Robert Dick Wilson, Caspar Wister Hodge, Gerhardus Voss, William Park Armstrong, J. Gresham Machen, and O.T. Alice. And the problem is that in 1929, the General Assembly reorganized the board of directors, the whole administrative structure of Princeton Seminary, so that the liberals got on the board, and they were able to cause great trouble for Machen, and really opposed orthodox teaching in some very subtle and sometimes not so subtle ways. And so remember now where we are in this building, in that pulpit, which would have been in that place, or maybe actually it was at that side of the church back in 1941, because in 46 they put it back to this, which is the way it was designed. But the same pulpit, anyway, is where James McCord, the fourth president of Princeton Seminary, preached for about a year and a half while he was finishing his doctorate there at Harvard Divinity School. And so, amazing, a very liberal in his theology, amazing that we should actually, in God's providence, own this building. It's a remarkable connection in history. But the reorganization of the board meant that orthodoxy was in huge trouble at Princeton. And so what happened is, on June 17th, 1929, Westminster Theological Seminary had its first classes meeting at the University Club in New York City, but then eventually ended up in Philadelphia. And Robert Dick Wilson, J. Gresham Machen, and O.T. Alice were the original professors, and then added to them were R.B. Kuyper, Cornelius Van Til, Alan McCrae, Ned Stonehouse, Paul Woolley, and then in 1930, John Murray. And so Machen summarized the threefold aim of this seminary: uphold the Westminster Confession as the best summary of the system of doctrine taught in Scripture, propagate the scholarly defense of the truth, and proclaim the truth without fear or favor. I always love the way he stated that last commitment, without fear or favor, to proclaim the truth of the gospel. Now, what happened then in 1932 is that there was the book called Rethinking Missions had a tremendous influence. It was the report of an interdenominational committee about foreign missionary work, in which Professor Hawking of Harvard basically said that all religions are true, and when we go out onto the mission field, we should hope to foster a good relationship between other religions and Christianity so that they can both prosper. And so this was complete modernism, of course. There was no supernatural gospel there at all. And so Machen went and overtured the General Assembly in the New Brunswick Presbytery in order to get a chance to show, and that's what this book is about, that the Board of Foreign Missions was completely saturated with men who did not believe the gospel any longer, and that that's what was being brought out onto the missionary field. And so Pearl Buck, of course, was a very famous missionary, a Presbyterian missionary in China. She wrote The Good Earth, and she was a very interesting woman of real integrity, as we'll see in a moment, even though she was a complete liberal in her theology. And so in 1933, the Independent Board of Foreign Missions was set up with Bai Machen and a number of others, because they basically said, why should God's people give money to a missions board that's sending out people that don't spread the gospel? It just doesn't make any sense, and it has no integrity. And so then, basically without going into the many details of his case, the church brought charges against Machen, said it would not allow him to defend himself in terms of the doctrinal problems, but rather on administrative charges, saying that not to fail to support the boards of the church meant that you were being insubordinate, and they would not allow him to talk about the doctrinal problems at all, but rather brought him up on charges, and those charges were sustained at the General Assembly in on June 3rd of 1936 in Syracuse, New York. And so he was basically defrocked and lost his Presbyterian Church USA ministry, or his credentials there. And it's so interesting to see the number of people that stood in his defense, completely outside the church, with the exception of Pearl Buck. H.L. Mencken, who was the real curmudgeon journalist and literary critic of the day, who didn't believe Christianity at all, and in fact had lots of snipes and kind of nasty things to say about Christianity, but he knew a man of integrity when he saw one, and he said, thus he fell out with the reformers who have been trying in late years to convert the Presbyterian Church into a kind of literary and social club devoted vaguely to good works. His one and only purpose was to hold it, the PCUSA, resolutely to what he conceived to be the true faith. He was forced out of Princeton, and he was marched off to Philadelphia with all the honors of war. Such a great statement by an unbeliever. Walter Lippmann, who was also himself a liberal, in his preface to his book on morals, wrote of Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, we shall do well to listen to Dr. Machen. The liberals have yet to answer him. So here's a liberal intellectual, and he was one of the leading intellectuals of the day, by the way, and he's saying that his argument, given the premises of what the church confesses, is airtight, and they have no answer to him. And then Pearl Buck finally, and here's, imagine this now, Machen was complaining about her very liberalism and the lack of integrity of Christians sending people out like Pearl Buck. But she understood that, and she said, I wish Dr. Machen had lived to go on fighting them, because she had the same kind of problems, I think, with the officials in the church that Mencken pointed out, wanting it to be a kind of literary and social club vaguely committed to good works. That's you didn't want to be on the wrong side of H.L. Mencken. So, happy birthday, June 11th, 1936. The New Century Club, 124 South 12th Street, First General Assembly of the OPC, just a small group. They could have fit into this room. I think there were something like 135, and they committed themselves solidly to Scripture and the Westminster Confession and catechisms, and that was the beginning of our church. Finally, a true Presbyterian church, those are the words of Machen, who was, of course, the first moderator of the General Assembly. He would die the next year in 37, and so he never got a chance to participate in the true church that he helped to begin. So we have time for questions, and I wanted to end there. I could go on, and in fact, originally what I just did was 2 weeks of Sunday school, so we compressed a lot into a small space since we don't have 2 weeks. So questions or comments? Yes, Keith. Yeah, in Grand Rapids, I believe. Yeah, that was really sort of like the culture war. He was a culture warrior of the day. Oh, exactly. And that's when I briefly mentioned the moderates who didn't speak up and do something and bring discipline against liberalism back in the day. They were the biggest part of the problem in many ways. And the other thing is that, you know, it's a real test of where your ultimate commitment is in terms of the gospel, but they lost all of their buildings. No one had a building because the church owned them. And that's one thing that's unique about the OPC, and probably the PCA, I think, has a similar kind of clause in its form of government that says that the local church always owns the building. Episcopalians now, who are seeking to maintain some orthodoxy, are finding out how bad a setup that is, that the local episcopacy owns the building, not the local church. So there's a picture in the latest World magazine that actually shows an Episcopal church full of people one Sunday, and then because the courts ruled against them, based on the legal documents, of course, and probably ruled correctly in one sense anyway, that they lost the building. And the next Sunday, they show a picture, and it's completely empty. There's nobody there, not even just a little tiny portion of the congregation. But the other thing, the mention of fundamentalism, that's absolutely correct, that Machen believed that was not a healthy term. He wanted to distinguish himself from fundamentalism as a broad term and call himself a confessional Presbyterian. And there's a huge difference between the two. At the beginning of the OPC, right after Machen died, immediately there was a conflict between those who wanted a broader confession and those who wanted to be stricter in terms of orthodoxy. And so there was some fundamentalist influence there in the beginning. And that, of course, had been fostered along during the teens and the 20s. But these lectures, I haven't heard them, my friend Daryl Hart gave, were probably in Sunday school at Glenside Church. Yeah, and those would be really worth listening to, because not only is Daryl a first-rank American church historian, but he specializes in Machen. I mean, he knows Machen better than anyone that I know living today. So worth listening to. Yeah, he came back a very serious Christian. And I think the other thing that was beneficial about Machen's going to Germany and studying there and going through the great conflict that he did intellectually and spiritually is that he was able to defend orthodoxy against the best minds in the theological world. And that's something that we need to also remember, that while not every pastor and certainly not every Christian can study in that way or even have the gifts to do that, we need to be fostering bright men in our seminaries studying and knowing what the enemy thinks so that we can ourselves defend it. And I love the way that Machen put it, to defend it in terms of intellectual integrity, but also in a way that is gentle and reasonable and respectful. And so one of the greatest ways to respect an opponent is to fully understand where that opponent is coming from. And that's what our great tradition has sought to promote educationally. John? Yeah, he died from natural causes, but the fact is that Machen was mentally and physically exhausted when he went out to go around to the different churches and was out in the Dakotas. And incidentally, it was the PCUSA was the name of the church back then, not the PCA, which brings up an interesting point that we were originally the PCA. So we called ourselves the PCA, and then we got sued by the PCUSA because the name was too similar. And, of course, there was a lot of acrimony underneath that suit. But we lost, and that's when we said, okay, we'll define ourselves in terms of what we believe is fundamental to this controversy, Orthodox. And so I was always amused that both here and in New Rochelle, I would get people asking if we were connected with the Greek Orthodox Church, and once I think the Russian Orthodox Church. So, well, we are in a way because we like orthodoxy. And so then it would be a good opening for a conversation about who we are. So in any case, Let's read one verse from 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6. He tells Timothy, the young minister, "If you put these things before the brothers, you will be a good servant of Jesus Christ, being trained in the words of the faith and of the good doctrine that you have followed." This would have, I'm sure, been a favorite verse of J. Gresham Machen.